right, welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. At the back end of the show, I'm really, really happy about this. We're going to be interviewing Stephen Sachs, a director, and Moreland Higgins, an actor, from the U.S. premiere of Atul Fugard's latest play, Blue Iris. And we'll be talking more about that at the back end of the show. Just a fantastic play. Before that, we'll be talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and one of the founders of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we'll be talking about nationwide protests focusing on stop and frisk on September 13th. Blow the whistle on stop and frisk, a call for nationwide resistance to racial profiling and police brutality. And opening the show up, I'm really, really happy to be doing this segment of the show. I think it's something that has been way too much overlooked, under-assessed, and just because people are not paying the requisite amount of attention, the kind of attention that needs to be paid to this, and that is to the National Defense Authorization Act, the way that that is ratcheting up the entire repressive state machinery and all this other stuff. And in particular, back in May, there was a ruling issued by a federal judge in a lawsuit that was filed challenging one of the clauses of that law. And the lawsuit, the judge issued a ruling that said that this was unconstitutional. But there was a lot more complicated than that. There was a lot tied up in that. And joining us to talk about this is Raymond Lotta. Raymond's a frequent guest on this show. He's a contributing writer for Revolution Newspaper and an advocate of Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism. Raymond, welcome to the show.
Well, Michael, thanks for having me on.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You were one of the initiators of a statement that has been issued around the National Defense Authorization Act. And that statement is basically calling on people to step out against this increased repression, a call to stand together to oppose the Obama administration's dangerous assault on fundamental rights. What's the story behind this? Where did this come from, and why is it here?
Yeah, I'm glad you're able to have me on the show to talk about this. The National Defense Authorization Act was passed, by Congress in December of 2011. This was a law that the Obama administration had been pushing through. And one of the provisions of this law, of this National Defense Authorization Act, sometimes referred to by the initials NDAA, one of the provisions of this law allows for and authorizes the government to indefinitely detain, that is, to put into military detention people without charge or trial for the alleged crime of associating with a very broad and vague category of people, including people who had nothing to do with 911 or with terrorism in general. So this is a provision of this act that authorizes indefinite military detention of a very broad and vague category of people. And the New York Times did a little piece on this, an editorial, one of the few newspapers to comment, in which they said that this law would make indefinite detention and military trials a permanent part of American law. So this is very, very ominous, Michael, and I'm glad that you have me here before your listening audience, because this law was passed, and it's very important to recognize that there was very little public discussion or awareness of this. It really represents a chilling assault on the rights of due process, speech, and association. And when it was being discussed in the House refused to amend the law to prevent this. And when this case, which I'm going to be talking about, was being heard in a court, the government, when pressed, refused to give assurances that people would be free to conduct their work. Individual journalists and progressive critics of the administration would be free to conduct their work without being confined in a military brig. In other words, the government refuses to give those kinds of assurances. So the first point is that this law was passed in December 2001. And then, as you mentioned in opening this segment, a lawsuit was filed, challenging this provision for indefinite military detention. And this lawsuit included several plaintiffs, like Chris Hedges, the journalist, several other activists, and their suit was later joined by Daniel Ellsberg and Noam Chomsky. And the activists and journalists, initiated that suit because they feared that their writings and associations might lead the government to put them into military detention, according to these you know, very ominous provisions that I'm talking about. So they filed this lawsuit in May. On May 16th, a federal district judge, Catherine Forrest, actually ruled in favor of the lawsuit, saying that this provision for indefinite military detention was unconstitutional, and she issued a temporary injunction against the law. That's now what's in effect. But right in the midst of her ruling, which was basically a positive ruling, but right in the midst of it was a reference to and an erroneous and very a potentially harmful mischaracterization of the Revolutionary Communist Party and its chairman, Bob Avakian. So this opens a whole new dimension, you know, in this case. That is, in a case that's being, you know, waged around this law, which gives the government broad authority to detain and to target people, now there is the fact that in her ruling, a genuine revolutionary organization and its leader, Bob Avakian, have been explicitly named and singled out as something they are not. And this is very threatening to the party and to Avakian, and it's something that is itself being challenged. A legal brief, you know, has been filed to set the record straight about what the Revolutionary Communist Party and Bob Avakian stand for. But in this ruling, there is, as I said, this egregious distortion of the party's stand and philosophy. You know, it says that the party endorses, and I'm quoting, the use of violence toward revolutionary ends, and that could lend itself to the false interpretation that the RCP might seek to achieve revolution through acts of terrorism. And this, as I said, is an egregious distortion because it can be construed, you know, as sweeping the party into this category of terrorist organizations. And the party and Avakian have publicly and repeatedly made clear their political and philosophical opposition to terrorism and have consistently taken the position that revolution is only possible when there's a revolutionary situation and a revolutionary people numbering in millions. And absent that kind of situation, you know, the task of revolutionaries is to raise the political and ideological consciousness of people and to build resistance to the abuses of the system. So here we are. Here's the situation. The NDA ruling, this lawsuit that was brought, the NDA is passed, is become a law. You have this lawsuit that challenged this provision for indefinite military detention. And then that is military detention of this broad and vague category of people, you know, that's very loose, very elastic, that gives the government far expanded and illegitimate authority to quash opposition, criminalize dissent, all in the name of this vague association with, you know, certain forces category. This is challenged. On May 16th, a judge rules in favor of that challenge, but incorporates into her ruling this distortion of the stand of the Revolutionary Communist Party. It names the party and its chairman in this section that follows paragraphs of discussion about terrorism. And this has created a new situation. That's the background for the public statement that I'm involved in. That is a statement that is calling out this repressive law, calling it out as part of a broader assault on fundamental rights of people, as I said, violations of due process, speech, association, and something that is part of the arsenal of the government to, you know, as I said, to suppress dissent, to criminalize dissent. And this is the situation that we're confronting. So this statement has been published.
Well, let me ask you this, Raymond. Let me ask you this before we get into the statement itself, okay? One of the things I think, you know, when you're – and let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Raymond Latta. And Raymond is a contributor to Revolution Newspaper, and he's an advocate of Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism. Now, Raymond, tell me this. You know, a lot of people might say, okay, well, maybe you're bending the stick a little too far. Maybe, you know, how dangerous actually is this? You know, and I keep thinking about, you know, the idea that – okay, there's all this, you know, this repressive stuff that the Obama regime has really, you know, ratcheted up, going way beyond Bush. We always, you know, people always say that. People who understand that say that. But then broadly, there's still a lot of kind of head in the sand around all this. And I was looking at, in the call that you put together, you actually refer to some of the things that lead up to this and feed into this and give people a sense of just how dangerous this kind of law is, and in particular, the danger that can be posed to the Revolutionary Communist Party, to Bob Avakian, you know, the criminalization of dissent, the case, the 2010 case of Holder versus the Humanitarian Law Project, and what that did in terms of where it took the breadth, how it expanded the breadth and the reach of this terribly repressive machinery. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah. Well, the 2010 case, that Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project, and that Holder is Eric Holder, the Attorney General. This, you know, establishes what's called a crime of material support for a listing of what are considered to be terrorist organizations. And that, of course, you know, what's considered to be terrorist is something the government just, you know, uses in broad brushstrokes in order to sort of, as I said, to demonize and isolate various organizations. But what it's done with this case, the government, you know, is now saying that the crime of material support includes even speaking with and advising various organizations, even on some legal matters. And that law now has been used against pro-Palestinian activists and endangers many others, including public intellectuals, you know, who've been speaking out about the crimes of imperialism in different parts of the world. So, you know, here you have, you know, the crime of material support, quote unquote, has been expanded to include merely speaking with and advising, even on some legal matters, organizations, you know, that have been tarred with this brush of terrorism by the government. And I thought your point is important about the Obama administration. A lot of people have sort of accepted this view, and or at least sort of just put their head into the sand about, you know, the Obama administration and what it's doing. There's this whole kind of narrative, well, it inherited all of these bad things, laws and repressive legislation from the Bush era, and that's just sort of part of what it, you know, carries on its shoulders. But in fact, Obama came to, you know, to the presidency, and this is mentioned in the public statement for signature that's being circulated. Now, he came to office promising to put an end to torture and other outrages, but in fact, he is putting into place a very dangerous system of control and repression, and he's expanding the dangerous and illegitimate authority of the government. In fact, there's the case you just mentioned, the Holder versus, you know, HLP, as it's called. Then there's this NDAA, which, as I said, now gives the government even greater authority to arbitrarily, unilaterally detain people in military prisons, you know, without charge or trial, as I said, for the vague, you know, crime of associating with a vague and broad category of people, you know, and that's now in the books, on the books, although there's this temporary injunction. Then, you know, Obama has enacted this whole assassinations policy, you know, the kill lists that are personally reviewed by the president, you know, with the drone strikes, et cetera. And Attorney General Holder has said that that assassination policy actually meets constitutional standards of due process because the president is going over it. So these are all examples of a pattern, which is not just the continuation of what the Bush administration, you know, put into place, but a ratcheting up, an escalation of these draconian measures, you know, to both detain, torture, and assassinate, and to restrict and criminalize dissent and opposition to the status quo.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Raymond Latta. And Raymond is a contributor to Revolution Newspaper, and he's an advocate of Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism. Now, Raymond, what you've been talking about and what you issued a call for and you were an initiator of is this statement that was actually designed, and again, the name of the statement is A Call to Stand Together to Oppose the Obama Administration's Dangerous Assault on Fundamental Rights. And you sort of talk about in a letter you wrote, you talk about the need to, and I'm assuming this is where the statement came from, the idea for a statement, the need to actually fight back against this in ways that create the most favorable conditions for determined resistance and broad unity. Can you talk about that, what that means? To explain to people what you're talking about there.
Yeah. Well, I think this statement, you know, that I've helped to initiate and write, which now has over 450 signers, including Daniel Ellsberg, who is one of the plaintiffs in the case, anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan, Peter Phillips of Project Uncensored, film and TV actor Peter Coyote. The purpose of this statement is to sound a wake-up call about what is happening. This, not only the continuation of these repressive measures of the Bush era, but an expansion and an enlargement of that in certain precedents. and mechanisms are being set that can be utilized against progressive, radical, and revolutionary forces. And it's a call on people to stand up to this assault on basic rights. And at the same time, and this is very critical, because incorporated into the May 16th ruling by a judge ordering a temporary injunction, which was very positive, but because something has been incorporated into, which is this distortion of the stand and philosophy of Revolutionary Communist Party, which, as I said, could be construed as putting into a category of terrorism, that because of that, you know, we now have this new situation where a genuine revolutionary organization has been singled out as something that it is not. So this statement is also declaring that we cannot allow the government to designate groups as politically acceptable or unacceptable, and we can't allow the government to peel away this or that group, you know, in the name of that's too radical, that's too extreme. And we can't allow the government to divide people out that way. So this statement is calling for people to stand together against this repressive act, against this broader repressive onslaught, and not to allow, you know, such groups, and here in this case, the Revolutionary Communist Party and its chairman, Bob Avakian, to be singled out and their work and what they stand for distorted in such a way that we have to fight this repressive onslaught in a way that strengthens our unity and our capacity to resist. And I do want to say, Michael, to your listening audience, this mention and reference to the party and Bob Avakian in the May 16th ruling, you know, has real implications. It is a great consequence. It's not just some sort of sidebar kind of event in this very complex legal battle, that this could actually be used to facilitate government prosecution, investigation, and harassment of the party and its chairman, Avakian, to restrict their activities, and also to invite and legitimize attempts by reactionary forces to go up against the party, you know, to take actions, to seek to intimidate, to seek to, you know, to carry out violent acts against the party and Avakian. You know, these are the kinds of things, you know, the dangers that are inherent in this. So this is being challenged both with a legal brief, and people can read the legal brief if they go to revcom, revcom.us, the legal brief that has been filed to set the record straight about what the party and Avakian actually stand for. And they can also go to revcom.us and learn about the party's revolutionary strategy. So they can go to revcom.us and look for the memorandum of concern, this brief, and they can go there and also read what's called some crucial points of revolutionary orientation, which spells out what the party's revolutionary strategy is. So this statement is an effort on the political front to rally people to take a stand against this repressive onslaught, the NDAA, this law, and to stand together. And here, I think it's to stand together and not to allow the government to divide out, to peel away the Revolutionary Communist Party in such a fashion. And here, there's the historical lesson of Martin Niemöller, the pastor who lived during the rise of the Nazi Party.
That's what I want to get into with you right now. We have about 2 minutes for you to cover that. So let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Raymond Latta. And Raymond is a contributor to Revolution Newspaper, and he's an advocate of Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism. Now, Raymond, let's get into that. I think it's an extremely important point to bring up now.
Yeah, well, in the statement, we quote from Pastor Niemöller. He was an Episcopalian, you know, religious leader, and he was describing his experience when confronted with the heightening repression carried out by the Nazi regime in Germany during the 1930s. He issued this famous statement. It was a reflection, a self-critical reflection, in which he said, "First they came for the communists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for me, and by that time, no one was left to speak out for me." And, you know, this is very important for people to acquaint themselves with the lessons of history. You know, this is something that was very, very real, and very, very real and pressing in Nazi Germany. What Niemöller was, you know, was responding to was the fact that the German intellectuals, you know, failed to speak out against the crimes of the Nazi regime, and that there was a conscious policy on the part of the Nazi regime, you know, to sort of choose its targets and one by one to purge and, you know, knock them out. this was what happened in, you know, in Nazi Germany. And Niemöller, looking back on it, because he wasn't taking a, you know, a stand against this, because he wasn't one of, quote, them at the time, you know, said that this was the slippery slope that, you know, that people have to learn from. So this statement is invoking that and reaffirming this principle that we can't allow the government to do this, that we have to stand together, and that we have to bolster and strengthen our capacity to stand against this injustice. And the Revolutionary Communist Party and its chairman, Bob Avakian, are a vital part of the political and intellectual and ideological landscape. Their work, their thinking, their politics had to be part of the discourse of today. It's essential, and we have to defend this.
All right, Raymond, thank you very much. And before we go, can you tell people if they want to see the statement, read it for themselves, think about signing it, whatever, where do they go?
They go to opposerepressionndaa.net. Opposerepressionndaa.net. They can add their names to this list. As I said, it's a diverse range of signers. They can write comments on this, and we hope to publish this statement soon, be talking more in the media about it, to be initiating forums and public discussion. So it's a very critical issue, and people can plug right in by going to opposerepressionndaa.net.
All right, Raymond, thank you very much. And we will be posting that on the KPFK website under my show after the show. So, Raymond Latta, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thanks again for having me on.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Raymond Latta, contributing writer for Revolution Newspaper and an advocate of Bob Avakian's New Synthesis of Communism, talking about the NDAA and the increasing dangers posed by it and all the moves that it's making to criminalize dissent. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Carl Dix to talk about September 13th and blowing the whistle on Stop and Frisk, so stay tuned. You caught me. You caught me up there. I'm sitting in the studio and I'm singing like crazy, okay? Just a great song. The Clash, Police on My Back. Joining us now is Carl Dix. Carl Dix is from the Revolutionary Communist Party and one of the founders of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and one of the initiators of September 13th, Blow the Whistle on Stop and Frisk, a call for nationwide resistance to racial profiling, police brutality. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Michael, and a good selection for the music.
You got it, man. You got it. I knew your head was banging as much as mine was in that one, man. Anyway, tell people what's going on here. You have a national day of resistance to, an expression of resistance to Stop and Frisk. Tell people, you know, what this day is, and then we'll get into more of the particulars about Stop and Frisk. But what's behind the call for this day?
Well, what's behind the call for this day is that from one end you have the intensifying unleashing of the whole criminal justice system against the people. I mean, police brutalizing and even killing people. The man in Saginaw, Michigan, shot 46 times by police. A couple weeks ago in Times Square in New York, a man surrounded and gunned down by police. A skateboarder in Venice, California, beaten down by police. Two young men murdered in Anaheim by the police days apart. All of this is going on, and there's many more things that I could talk about that we don't have time to get into. But that's going on. But then at the same time, there is a mood of resistance and defiance that's been building and is very significant, and we feel must be built on, you know, going through the response to the execution of Troy Davis, the response to the vigilante murder of Trayvon Martin, what's been going on around Stop and Frisk here in New York, the prison hunger strikes, California, West Virginia, Georgia. So we feel like this is a moment when it's important to take the resistance to a higher level, to spread it, make it broader, more determined, and to actually beat back some of the attacks that the criminal justice system is bringing down, especially on Black and Latino people. But this is a question for anybody with any concern about humanity. So what we decided was September 13th would be a day to do that, and we developed a form that could very broadly involve people. Because last fall, Cornel West and I issued a call for nonviolent civil disobedience, which was very important, very effective, and helped to bring about some of the heightened resistance. But we wanted a forum this year that people very broadly could participate in. So in New York, we hit upon getting out tens of thousands of whistles to people all across the city and calling them into the streets in the afternoon to challenge police violating people's rights, challenging them politically with whistles and cameras. And we want to spread this nationwide for people to act in solidarity in various forms, going to prisons, going to police stations, going to wherever the criminal justice system is handing out abuse to people and blowing the whistle on that crap.
And let me remind listeners that we're talking with Carl Dix. He's from the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he's one of the initiators of September 13th, Blow the Whistle and Stop and Frisk, a call for nationwide resistance to racial profiling, police brutality and murder, and the pipeline leading to mass incarceration. You know, Carl, that just the name of this day, of this action, concentrates so much. And I was thinking about this in terms of the, you know, you talked about the brutality and the murder, but there's also this question of pipeline leading to mass incarceration, which really then combines with the question of slow genocide. And I think the point that you were making about, well, it's not just, yes, it mainly happens to Black and Latino people. And believe me, you know, after, you know, one just spending a couple of weeks in New York and going out as with part of the Basics bus tour and going out and talking to a whole lot of people, and especially in these neighborhoods where stop and frisk is concentrated, you find mainly when you're talking to guys, you find guy after guy after guy who will tell you, so I had one guy tell me he's been stopped 30 times in 2 years. You know, you think about that, you know, and then there's probably more frequently things going on than that. But you think about what this means and the idea that this such a massive thing is happening and what it's doing and how it's related to this whole question of genocide, a slow genocide that's related very much to the pipeline to prison. Can you talk about that a little? And because that's something that people really, in terms of ethically and morally and in terms of humanity, people have got to stand up around that, not just about whether or not it's happening in my city or it's happening to me personally, but there's a whole bigger question there of, are we going to stand by and allow this genocide to go on?
Yeah, you're hitting right on a very important point, Michael, because what we have in this country is a situation where tens of millions of people live their lives enmeshed in the criminal justice system. I mean, because you talk about mass incarceration, 2.4 million people warehoused in prisons. But then you have to add in the racial profiling, whether it's an official policy like stop and frisk, or whether just how the police operate, targeting Blacks and Latinos for disrespect, harassment, and brutality, and even worse. Then, even after people have served their sentences, after they've been punished, they're under the control of the parole and probation, still within the criminal justice system, discriminated against when they go looking for work, not allowed to live in public housing, not allowed to get a government loan to try to go back to school and get an education or start a business, and they can't even vote, you know. So, and then you have the loved ones of all of these people, and that's why I say it's tens of millions of people. And I do not use the term genocide lightly. I actually went to the international definition of genocide. And it's not just when people get lined up against the wall and shot. That is a form of genocide, but that's the end point. That's where things ended up in Nazi Germany. But it's important to look at how they developed. And the international definition comes down to when a group of people in whole or in part are put into conditions that make it impossible for them to survive and thrive as a people. And when you look at the situation, especially for Black people, but also for large sections of Latinos as well, it is actually those kinds of conditions. people in positions that they're unable to survive and thrive as a people. And mass incarceration concentrates those conditions. That's why I came up with the slogan, mass incarceration plus silence equals genocide, with the corollary that it's time to break the silence. And September 13th, we're going to shatter that silence in a big way, including with the whistles, but with people taking to the streets and challenging politically this kind of treatment.
And let me remind listeners that we're talking with Carl Dix. He's from the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he's one of the initiators of September 13th, Blow the Whistle on Stop and Frisk, a call for nationwide resistance to racial profiling, police brutality and murder, and the pipeline leading to mass incarceration. Well, you know, one of the things, Carl, that comes up is, and I think it's really interesting, because when you mentioned the young brother in Venice, who was a college student from Xavier University in Louisiana. He's home for whatever the summer. He's out. He's skateboarding. And, you know, they then, you know, when they beat the hell out of him, broke his nose, broke a cheekbone, you know, and then they actually had the audacity to talk about when they say, well, he's, you know, he's got, you know, basically they say, well, he's got a jacket. And you look at what's going on here is he's got a file that talks about he's been stopped for skateboarding on the wrong side of the street. You know, things like that are like riding his bicycle in the wrong direction, you know, things like this. And it made me think of a comment that you made. And I know there's a lot of questions that come up around, you know, stop and frisk. A lot of people talking about, well, doesn't it do some good? And what about the fact that, like, people like the police commissioner and the governor have talked about they're going to tweak this here and there to try and save it? And you're talking about, you get right to a point in an article you wrote recently saying, look, let's just get right to the point. Stop and frisk is racist and illegitimate. Full stop. No question. Now we got to deal with it on the basis of what is going to be a commensurate response. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because it's also a huge question. Give people a sense also of the immensity of this. It's nationwide, yes, but then there's an immensity that's really concentrated in the places in New York that we've been talking about too.
Yeah, it is really immense in New York. It's the numbers that you talked about, let's just break it down this way. About 2,000 people each and every day get stopped by the NYPD under stop and frisk for any reason or for no reason at all. Most of them are black or Latino, and almost all of them were doing nothing wrong, nothing the police could even trump up any reason to arrest them or even write them a ticket. That's what's going on, and it comes down to a whole generation of people being treated like criminals. That's what we're dealing with here. That's why I say the racism of it is obvious on the surface, but it is just illegitimate and unjust. And then when people start saying, well, doesn't it deal with crime? No, it does not deal with crime. And you can see that even with their numbers, because almost everybody they stop is not doing anything criminal, is not doing anything suspicious, except going about their lives as a black or brown person. That's what most people are doing when they get stopped. It doesn't get guns off the street. For every 1,000 stops, they get one gun. I mean, if they wanted to get guns, a couple weeks ago, a church group in Queens collected 500 and some guns with a gun buyback. They did a whole lot better than the NYPD all throughout the city in that period if you wanted to do something like that. So that's not what they're trying to do. They're trying to control and suppress a targeted group of people. And that's what this is about. That's why I say it's racist and it's illegitimate. And then you have to say, what do you do about illegitimate racist activity? Do you tweak it? Do you make it less illegitimate, less racist? Or do you get rid of it? And we are aiming to stop it, and that's why Cornel West and I issued this call for blowing the whistle on stop and frisk, because it has to be stopped, just like mass incarceration has to be stopped. We're not looking for better, leaner, meaner stop and frisk. We're looking to get rid of that because it is no good. Our youth should not be treated as criminals, and no one should support them being treated as criminals because of the talk about crime and violence that the mayor and the police chief engage in.
And let me remind listeners that we're talking with Carl Dix. He's from the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he's one of the initiators of September 13th, Blow the Whistle on Stop and Frisk, a call for nationwide resistance to racial profiling, police brutality and murder, and the pipeline leading to mass incarceration. All right, Carl, we have about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to try and squeeze in a couple of questions here. One is, you know, when you think about this, there were also some recent articles in the New York Times that were actually pretty surprising on one level with it, that they actually admitted this stuff when they talked about the use of violence and violent force in relation to stop and frisk, and where in some neighborhoods it was 20% of the people stopped were actually brutalized by the police. In other neighborhoods, it was 40%. You know, and you think about this, the combination of the brutality, the idea of the terrorizing, the whip snapping, and actually the whip lashing that actually goes on, you know, metaphorically and really in reality. And then it also talked about the idea that which a lot of people don't even think about, that this also hits women. And they talked about the very special degradation that's dished out to women when they're stopped and frisked. Can we talk about those two things?
Yeah, those are both very important things. And what it comes down to is I'm out every day among people getting stopped and frisked. We're getting their stories, and we're going to begin to collect those stories and make them accessible in a variety of ways. But what it comes down to is people who say, "Why are you doing this to me?" or "You're violating my rights," are very often the targets of the brutality. And a very sharp and clear message is being delivered. Don't even question what we do to you. We can do anything we want to you. And it's a dehumanizing message as well, both the brutality that they bring down on people, but also the targeting of women that goes on within this, because most of the victims are men, but they do some very special things to women. I mean, you have these male cops, because it's overwhelmingly male cops doing this, who are groping women on the street, sexually assaulting them, basically, under the guise of some kind of anti-crime or anti-violence policy. And sometimes they just put the cat out of the bag. I talked to three young women who were stopped and frisked by cops who said they were looking for a male rapist. Now, why do you frisk three young black women looking for a male rapist? You're obviously telling them right there, "I can do this to you. I can come up with any reason or no reason at all and carry it out." This is why we have to stop it. And one other thing to say about the coverage in the New York Times is that what it reflects is that the people on top of society, the folks who run the show, are divided about how to go forward and worried about the level of resistance and how this could pull the covers off of more of their setup, maybe even the whole setup, and saying maybe we should tamp this down some. Maybe we should ease off of some of it. While you got others like the police chief Kelly who are like, "No, we have to go ahead with this. This is the centerpiece of how our cops operate here," which is actually true. It is a centerpiece of how cops operate here, and it tells you what they're out to do, not control crime, not to keep people safe, but to suppress and control people. That's what this comes down to, and people really need to be a part of this. They need to get whistles and be out on September 13th. Let me give people ways to get information and get involved. One is to go to the website www.stopmassincarceration.org. That's stopmassincarceration, all one word, .org. We're going to put up organizing kits and, you know, information for how people could get involved. And, you know, if there's something happening near you, write us. We'll tell you if there's something happening near you. If there's nothing happening where you are, start something. Get involved in this. And then the other thing is people could go to www.revcom.us. That's revcom.us. There's a call for nationwide resistance on September 13th that I co-authored with Clyde Young. That I think would be helpful for people in figuring out how to go with this.
And just one thing I wanted to congratulate you on is you came up with a very unique and I think really inspiring way that people all across the country can, you know, actually come together as one force on September 13th. I thought that was really incredible. The 6 p.m. Can you tell people what's happening at 6 p.m. on September 13th?
I almost forgot. 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Everybody across the country, wherever you are, blow your whistles. We'll all be blowing the whistle on stop and frisk and the way the whole criminal injustice system comes down on people. So at that time, if you're in school, at work, coming home, in your neighborhood, you're running a basketball game, stop and blow your whistles. And then tell people why you're blowing the whistle and what you're blowing the whistle on.
All right, Carl, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael, for having me on.
All right, take care, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and one of the founders of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and one of the initiators of the September 13th Blow the Whistle on Stop and Frisk Day, a call for nationwide resistance to racial profiling, police brutality and murder, and the pipeline to prison. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by the director, Stephen Sachs, and Moreland Higgins, an actor in the U.S. premiere of Atul Fugard's latest play, Blue Iris. So stay tuned for that. Welcome back. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and that was Carew Dawn, which I thought was actually a fitting song for this next segment of the show. Joining us is Stephen Sachs, director, and Moreland Higgins, actor, and they're both involved in the U.S. premiere of Atul Fugard's latest play, Blue Iris. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah. Well, Stephen, let's start with you. Tell people what this play is about. I mean, I have to say, I read the script last night, and I'm really dying to see it tonight. And when I read the script, I was just floored by it. I mean, I really had to stop and sit back and just like, wow.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I feel exactly the same way. It's a beautiful new play by Atul Fugard, who is an internationally renowned, world-famous playwright from South Africa. And the play is about a farmer in South Africa whose farmhouse has just burned down. It's been struck by lightning and burned to the ground. And he and his housekeeper are sifting through the debris of the house and their lives. And the play is about the memories and deep hidden secrets that come up and are revealed through going through the debris of the house. It's a beautiful, powerful, moving new play by a world famous and important playwright.
Yeah, he's actually one of the it's incredible. He's actually one of the most performed playwrights in the world as well, and actually probably only beaten by Shakespeare. Right?
That's there you go. That's correct
in the English language anyway. And one of the things, though, Moreland, actually, let me ask you this, because one of the things that happens in most of Fugard's plays, but especially in this one, because I should tell people, it's two scenes in one act, and it's really, it's such a small space, and a lot of his, even the physicality, the physical set of his plays are so small, but so much is concentrated in that. How do you find working with that?
Oh, I love it, and as a matter of fact, like we did with previous Fugard plays,
The two scenes is actually now one scene. We've condensed it even further. He writes intimate little things like that. And I think it's because, and this is my fourth Fugard play, I think it's because he loves to get to the universal through the specific. And through a very specific human experience, he is talking about his country and the state of his country and that culture and the world. It's really a lot of fun to do because you don't have to be political. You just have to be true to that character, tell that story.
But as an actor, you're aware of all this. And where do you go to actually, because, you could carry it out on a very sort of superficial level, not that you would, but, in a way that even if you're trying your damnedest, but still, I saw you in Train Driver and was really impressed with your work. And it was a very similar situation where so much was concentrated in such a small space. Where do you go to actually, how do you actually carry out this part in a way that makes it real, that makes it as hard hitting as it can be, as it needs to be?
You know, that's a hard one to answer. I just say that you just believe in the importance of that human being's journey and try and get in that river and just go with the current of it, not be distracted by all of these other things. Just give that person life on the stage, you know?
Stephen, you've been directing few arts plays for a long time here, right?
Right, yes, about 12 years now.
Yeah, and how do you deal with a situation like that? That must be a unique experience for directors, too. I mean, you have to be so honed in on that small space in time and physical space.
Well, like Moreland says, it's so specific. And although his plays are perhaps intimate in size, they are immense in stature. He writes these intimate human stories about the journey of the human heart, and that is why his plays are performed everywhere around the world, because any human being seeing a Fugard play will identify with the journey of these people. And that's what makes them so powerful and so meaningful.
Fugard said recently that he said, "We should be going into people's lives, their souls, their way of life. Everything I have written is an attempt to share secrets with you." What do you think about that?
Well, yes. Again, it's opening the window into the human heart, the human soul, that he is just a genius at. And here he is. This year also, we're celebrating Athol's 80th birthday. He turned 80 this year. And he is still writing these miraculous gems of plays, and he is just an artist so worthy of honoring and celebrating.
Now, Moreland,
yeah,
did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
No, that was pretty eloquent. I thought that makes sense to me.
All right, well, let's break some stuff open here, because Moreland, one of the characters in your play, and I was reading this somewhere in some comment that Fugard made about this play and about his plays in general, about the male characters in his play, that there's always some kind of – there's always a flaw that, you know, whatever's going on. That, and in particular in this play, the man through most of the play is, you know, he's portrayed one way, and then some things are revealed through revealing these secrets. You know, how did you find that? I mean, what do you – you know, it's – I'm trying to get at it. It's a really interesting way that things turn. You know, where these very flawed people, and they actually, and particularly, well, we can get into the rest of that later, but these very flawed people are actually presented on stage, and they carry with them a very deep secret and a very revealing secret itself as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, if the hero doesn't have a flaw, there's not going to be much of a story, you know, and Fugard does that, like you said, with male characters, and I think a lot of it has to do with I don't know that he's a feminist. I don't think he is, but it has to do with the patriarchal energy that pretty much sets up these terrible situations, like what was the old South Africa, and even still a lot of the new South Africa. So he frequently has his male heroes learning from the female, or even if it's with another male, it is in a traditionally feminine sort of power structure, you know, that the guy on top, the guy with all the power seemingly, is the one who needs to learn the lesson, which I think is really central to a lot of his work. And if you know, if you look at it, it's Lear, it's Coriolanus, I mean, it's Othello, it's all of those Shakespearean characters too, and it's Greek. That's where his heart is. Everything comes from the Greek.
He's also, I think, it was influenced a lot by his mother. His mother was a very powerful figure in his life. A lot of his plays reflect these powerful female characters who deliver a positive message of hope and redemption for the male character.
Right, and she was the Afrikaans half of his parenthood.
Right.
His father was English and Irish, South African, and she was an Afrikaner.
Correct.
Actually, it's interesting because in the play it's reversed. The man is the Afrikaner, and the woman is the English.
Right,
Yeah, very interesting. I want to pursue that a little bit more, but I also want to let people know that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Stephen Sachs, the director, and Moreland Higgins, one of the actors in the U.S. premiere of Athol Fugard's latest play, Blue Iris. Let me pursue this a little bit more, because you were saying about the universality of what he brings out in terms of where he's rooted and everything else and how he portrays this. But he also is very specific around South Africa, and even the set for this, in terms of not the physical set, because I haven't seen that, but actually the description of it.
Mm-hmm.
The burnout farm, the wreck of life, the you know, all of these things, the turnaround, he captures even there. He's very specifically South African, and mm-hmm. and he's known as actually really capturing the South African people, and not just the white people in South Africa, actually trying to deal with the interconnection and the not ambiguity, but the certainty of the complexity of that society. It's always amazed me with his work how well he does that, how much he zeroes in on that.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find doing that, Stephen, directing with it?
The setting of the plays is obviously crucial. In the last couple of plays that he's been writing, they've shared this kind of desolate setting. And Train Driver, the play took place in a kind of lost and forgotten graveyard of lost souls. And this play is a burned out farmhouse. And they all kind of have this, like what Moreland was saying, this kind of Greek mythic kind of existential setting where human beings are put in these environments and are thrust together to wrestle over the struggle for hope and survival. He always asks these very central, prime questions about what it is to be a human being and how is it that we can go forward in what often seems like a dark and cruel world. And he does find hope. He always says, Athol does, that he says, I'm an optimist. And he always tries to find that ray of light, which at the end of each play, a journey towards some kind of deliverance of hope and redemption for these people, mm-hmm. Which always makes his work deeply poetic and beautiful and deeply meaningful.
And another thing about this setting, too, is that it's specifically in the Karoo, which is desolate. I mean, I just came back from Ireland. I was there visiting a couple of weeks ago, and it was my first time there. It was so wonderful. And we spent a few days up in Donegal and on these green rolling hills, and it's all sheep farms. Well, this takes place on a sheep farm. This is a sheep farm in the Karoo. And it's very different. The Karoo is desert-like, and the vegetation is very sparse. So these sheep herders use horses to chase their sheep around to some place where they can find something to eat, as opposed to Ireland, where it's just everything's so lush and green.
Right.
And it is that sort of wasteland feeling that all of those Greek characters, or many of them, are lost in at some point, you know? It's very much like going into the underworld, if you will, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, I've been to the Karoo, and boy,
yeah,
you're not giving it. You're not doing justice to the immensity, the barrenness of
it. Oh yeah, yeah.
And you know, it's very. And then, and again, the blue iris representing this thing that actually what you see in there are there are these things that are extremely beautiful that actually grow up. Some of these flowers, the succulents, some of these things that happen there that grow there, and yet they also carry a negative side to them too, which is a very interesting thing to me, because I also found the set, the burnout farm, the rest of this, in relation to South Africa today, you know, very heavy, especially as we're looking at the news where people are confronted with the idea that, look, 34 miners killed by stuff that looked like Sharpeville or Soweto, you know. I mean, I've watched that video time and time again, and I kept saying 1976, 1963, whatever, mm-hmm. but it's 2012. Mm-hmm. So what do you guys think of that?
Well, yeah, I obviously realized, too, that, of course, the house, the farmhouse, is the country, like in so many of Athol's plays. But, of course, you can't play that. The audience will make that a connection themselves. But, mm-hmm. yes, indeed, it's very much the soul of the land that is barren and dying. And the whole experience of Mandela walking out of prison, and all of the hope and dreams that country had, that the world shared. The whole world was focused on South Africa during that period as a beacon of light and a ray of hope, I think, for all of us. It was such a promising story. And I know Athol and many South Africans feel that the country today has not fulfilled its promise. And that is also what he is writing about.
All right, let me ambush you guys with a one quick surprise, just basically right off the top of your head. Stephen, you in particular, you have directed so many of Fugard's plays. You've been in obviously have a longstanding relationship with him. You're very familiar with him and his work. What surprises you in this play? Is there any surprise, anything that took you back and said, whoa, I really...
There's a section in the play that takes a unique spin, a kind of a heightened spin. I don't want to say too much about it because I want audiences to be surprised by it, as I was when I first read this play. He is experimenting with an interesting form in this play that is new to him and to me, and that was a very pleasant and exciting surprise.
Yeah, I agree. Morla.
This play is more outside in the jazz sense of the word than he has gone before, and it's kind of wonderful to think a guy who just turned 80 is still writing every day of his life for the past 60 odd years, and is now trying something new.
Yeah, he's still experimenting with new forms.
It's great.
Yeah,
it's great.
Writing so ferociously, yes. Actually, and voraciously, and actually constantly digging deeper and deeper into the whole human experience, which to me is just a mammoth contribution to the world.
And he has another new play coming up.
All right. Well, we'll have you back to talk about that one. Okay. All right. And we have been talking with Stephen Sachs, the director, and Moreland Higgins, one of the actors in Atul Fugard's latest play, The Blue Iris. Really, really remarkable play. If you get a chance to see it, don't miss it. If you get a chance to read it, do it, all right? It's really an incredible play. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. Now, real quick, I want to let you know that we are going to go out with a song that actually has a lot to do, oddly enough, with South Africa and the whole anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa that happened beginning in the, it happened for a long time, but it really reached a crescendo in the late 80s, the mid to late 80s. And the apartheid was formally ended in South Africa, but unfortunately, liberation wasn't achieved because to get that, you need a revolution. And they didn't have one, all right? But we're going to go out with a song from Rodriguez. Rodriguez, if you saw the film Searching for Sugar Man, you're familiar with Rodriguez. He's a cat who made a couple of albums. They didn't sell very well in the States. In South Africa, they were million sellers, and they helped to inspire the white people involved in the anti-apartheid movement. Rodriguez became a big hero to the anti-apartheid movement among white students, intellectuals, and white activists in South Africa. So check this out. The song is, this is not a song, it's an outburst. Yeah!
The mayor hides the crime rates. Councilwoman hesitates, public gets irate, but forgets the vote date. Weatherman complaining, predicted sun, it's raining. Everyone's protesting, boyfriend keeps suggesting, you're not like all of the rest. Garbage ain't collected, women ain't protected. Politicians using, people they're abusing. The mafia's getting bigger, like pollution in the river. And you tell me that this is where it's at. Woke out this morning with an ache in my head. I splashed on my clothes as I spilled out of bed. I opened the window to listen to the news, but all I heard was the establishment's blues. Gun sales are soaring, housewives find life boring. Divorce the only answer, smoking causes cancer. The system's gonna fall soon to an angry young tune. And that's a concrete cold fact.